Welcome back to M&A Access. My name is Ekaterina. Today we are at the summer conference in Chicago, and I am joined by Rich Weiner.
Correct.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How is the summer conference treating you so far?
Been going very well, very informative, and have made some great connections. And I'm looking forward to the follow-ups once we're done here.
That's great. So you and I are going to discuss tax planning and deal structure in M&A. But before we begin, share a little bit about yourself, about your background in M&A.
Sure. My background in the technical sense, I come at this from being a commercial tax partner. And over the course of my career, I'd been doing some M&A from the perspective of having clients either do an acquisition to add on to their company or ultimately sell. Come a number of years back, started to get more and more interested in this space and learning that there was a lot more to it than the tax planning aspect to it, understanding what the investment bankers do, what the attorneys do, and how everything fits together in terms of the whole M&A ecosystem, and how a strong tax plan, both going in during negotiations and after the transaction, can really benefit our clients.
Mm-hmm. So what is your current role?
I'm just a commercial tax partner at AAF CPAs.
Okay.
We're a regional firm based in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And about 80% of my time is spent in the transaction advisory area.
Mm-hmm. So why are those areas so important in M&A right now?
We have a very dynamic tax structure in place. At the federal level, rates have stayed relatively constant since 2017. You never know what's going to happen as the result of either midterm elections or the next presidential election a little over 2 years from now. You also have very aggressive states that are contending with their own shortfalls, looking for ways to raise revenue, while at the same time, higher tax jurisdictions are dealing with a number of wealthy individuals who are moving out of state to areas where perhaps the tax rates are more favorable to those individuals and their companies.
Mm-hmm. For those listeners who are not tax specialists, including me, can you explain the phrase deal structure in plain English?
Sure. At its core, the deal structure can either take the form of a sale of stock or a sale of assets. There are hybrid structures in other elections you can make where a stock or security sale could be treated as an asset sale or purchase, but at its core is the company selling, and is the acquirer buying stock, or are they buying the company's assets, and how it will be treated for tax purposes, mm-hmm. irrespective of the legal treatment.
Mm-hmm. So walk me through the process. When should tax planning begin if a business owner is thinking about selling?
Sooner rather than later, because some aspects of planning require a number of years to implement, while others can be implemented a little bit closer to going to market. If a company is a flow-through entity, such as an S corporation, does it want to take the steps to convert itself to a C corporation in order to take advantage of the qualified small business stock rules? Now, going in that direction puts other fiscal disciplines upon the company that might not be palatable in terms of how they operate, but it's something that you need to identify and implement sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. And what are some hidden costs of selling a business without a plan?
You never know. You leave money on the table if you don't plan properly. If you're looking to pass along some of the net after-tax proceeds to the next generation, does it make sense, well in advance of going to market, to perhaps gift or transfer shares into a trust for the benefit of children, grandchildren, or what have you, or transfer stock directly to them? If you live in a high tax jurisdiction, is it workable for you in terms of your day-to-day life to pull up stakes from an expensive jurisdiction? California, New York, Illinois, and Massachusetts get the headlines, but there are others, and relocate to a lower tax jurisdiction such as Nevada, Texas, New Hampshire, or Florida. They tend to be common destinations for folks on the West Coast and the East Coast, respectively.
And what are some common tax issues sellers overlook before going to market?
Just those are the types of things, how you want to structure. As you get closer to when the deal is in process, you just want to look at things. You want to make sure that you can continue operating the company in the manner that you have, irrespective of what plans you put in place before. I mean, it's interesting. We're having a tax discussion. I have a tax background. And at the same time, I always remember to remind clients, don't forget that you have a business to run. And there are some things that we can do tax-wise that might get in the way of your optimizing your ability to run the business during negotiations, as well as get the highest possible sales price. Taxes are a very significant part of the transaction, but they're not the only part. And for all of us, regardless of what field we practice in, always have to remind ourselves of that.
I want to hear a story from you now. Have you seen a situation where a seller was surprised by the tax impact after focusing only on the headline number?
Yes. If the company is selling as an S corporation because that made sense, they may think in terms of selling their stock and what is the gain on the sale of stock. However, if the transaction gets structured as an asset purchase, now you have a situation where the gain, some of it may be capital gain. The vast majority of it usually is. Some of it may be taxed as ordinary income. You need to plan for that. Additionally, if the company operates in a state that imposes entity-level taxes on an S corporation, that can be another unwanted surprise, especially if the individual lives in a different state but may have some business operations in a high-tax state. The way you get around that, and this is where planning comes in for that type of situation, is to negotiate through the legal teams what's called a tax gross-up, which is to say, if I sold my stock for X, meaning that I would walk away with Y, if we're going to go with an asset sale, it has to be X plus some amount for me to walk away with that same amount after tax. Sometimes buyers go along with it, sometimes they don't, sometimes they split the difference. Every transaction is unique in that regard.
Why do buyers and sellers often choose different structures?
A buyer would like a transaction treated as an asset purchase, primarily because it gives them the ability to depreciate or amortize the purchase price. So if you think about a company that has a, what I'll call a decent book value, call it $10 million, but the purchase price is going to be $40 million. So there's a $30 million premium. In an asset purchase, the buyer has the ability to amortize that premium over 15 years, obtain some tax benefits as they go, and be able to defray the overall purchase price with those tax savings.
And what are some of the tax consequences of a stock sale that buyers need to understand?
In the example I just gave, that $30 million premium would not be amortizable unless the buyer wanted to do some things after the close that would create a tax impact on its own books long after the seller is gone.
Okay, so let's talk about the buyer's side first.
Sure.
What tax issues should be reviewed during due diligence?
You want to make sure that if the buyer operates in multiple states as part of the due diligence process, you ask simple questions. Where are your employees located? Does the company file income tax returns in those states? Are the company's products or services taxable from a sales tax standpoint? Have they been properly collecting and remitting sales tax or collecting the appropriate documentation to say that the sale is not taxable in a given state? There is also what's called use tax, which applies really to the seller's home state, and that if they're making purchases for their own use that they did not pay sales tax on, are they paying use tax on? that's very low-hanging fruit if a state revenue department wanted to examine the company's books. From the buyer side, in addition to whether or not there were the operational synergies there or the product synergies that are leading them to have interest in a deal, they also want to minimize risk. And it's up to the sellers to go through advanced planning to minimize that risk or identify those areas and have them fixed before a buyer's due diligence team ever starts to look at the books.
And what tax liabilities most often surprise buyers after closing?
Hidden sales and use tax. I mean, sales tax or corporate income tax for that matter. You know, the expression we use in the office is 50 states, 50 sets of rules. And now you apply that to multiple types of tax, corporate tax, sales and use tax. That's usually where the easiest areas of a potential miss are, whether or not the underlying dollars are significant.
So how should the team of, you know, tax advisors, legal counsel, and investment bankers work together during this process?
There should be constant communication amongst folks, amongst the groups of people you just mentioned. For a deal to go as smoothly as possible, all three practitioners, the investment banker, the attorneys, and the accountants should be in constant contact with one another, periodic meetings with the clients so everybody knows what everybody else is thinking, and to identify areas during the negotiating and due diligence process so that these issues can be addressed and flagged internally before it becomes problematic to the buyer.
Where does it usually break? Where is the most challenging step in a process?
It's usually during the negotiation. When you've got the LOI signed, you're negotiating the purchase agreement, and you start to learn what's really important to a buyer, what's really important to a seller. Ideally, much of this would have been identified prior to signing the letter of intent. That does not always happen. So you want to be able to address, if you're representing the seller, you want to be able to address the buyer's inquiries as best you can, and even more so, anticipate them. From the accounting firm perspective, because if we're frequently going to be tasked with preparing the tax return after the close, so one of the things that we always look for is to have the wording as it relates to tax preparation, tax a cutoff, whatnot, be as specific as possible. There are other areas where, as the accounting firm, we can have a lot of input, such as if there's going to be an earnout. The tax rules regarding earnouts are pretty straightforward, but we want to make sure that the underlying language governing earnouts is very specific as to how they will be calculated. Oftentimes, that may not be addressed in an agreement. So what we recommend to our sellers is that the earnout be computed in a manner consistent with the seller's historical accounting practices, because otherwise you're setting things up for a dispute. Irrespective of how clean everything else is from a tax perspective, there are other areas where the CPA firm working with a client can be a benefit beyond the straight tax structuring.
So let's move on to the sale side now, the seller side. What should sellers clean up before they start a sale process?
They want to have their books cleaned up in general. Oftentimes, some companies, they might have somebody who has the title of controller, but they're a glorified senior accountant based upon their background and skill set. Within our firm, we have a group that does outsourced accounting that can work with the seller's internal team to get their books cleaned up. We will also ask the due diligence questions in terms of the state tax matters I discussed a few moments ago. Well, where are your revenues? What are you filing? What haven't you filed? Let's quantify the exposure. And it's really a matter of helping the seller prepare for buyer's due diligence. Similarly, we will work with a company to do what we call a quality of earnings light, which is the financial analysis that may not involve the overall report that the investment banker is putting together. But it's all about setting the seller's expectations and trying to anticipate the buyer's inquiries as best possible based upon what we see.
Mm-hmm. What mistake do business owners make when they wait too long to involve tax advisors?
They could end up with a structure that doesn't suit their interest. They'll have missed an opportunity, perhaps, of taking advantage of the qualified small business stock rules or other areas that involve estate planning and gift planning and whatnot. And they just tend to focus more on the top line rather than the bottom line.
Okay, so now let's talk a little bit about negotiation and deal terms. How do tax considerations show up in negotiation?
I think one of the most obvious areas involves purchase price allocation, especially if the seller is an S corporation, a limited liability treated as a partnership or whatnot. From a seller's perspective, the purchase price can be treated as either ordinary income with the tax rate federally as high as 37%, or as capital gain with the tax rate of 20%. Mm-hmm. So from the seller's standpoint, you want to put as much towards intangible assets such as goodwill in order to maximize the amount taxed at the 20% rate. The buyer, on the other hand, would like to have as much of the purchase price allocated towards equipment because they can deduct that immediately in certain scenarios, as opposed to the 15-year amortization period for goodwill and other intangibles. So that's one area of potential conflict. The mistake we see too many times is that an agreement, call it a stock agreement that somebody pulls off a shelf, looks to allocate the purchase price for equipment based upon its net book value for financial reporting purposes rather than tax purposes. This can create an area of conflict because for tax purposes, the seller may have fully expensed that equipment during the years in which they've been operating the company, which could potentially increase the amount of ordinary income. So that's the technical answer. The tactical answer is one way of addressing this is to obtain an appraisal for the equipment. Or if it's a company that has a lot of vehicles, as we all know, purchases of HVAC companies, heating companies, landscapers, and other home service companies are a very hot target these days for potential buyers. They may have a lot of vehicles. One tactic may be to look at Kelley Blue Book or a similar document to see what they appraise the vehicle to be worth and insist that that be used as the valuation. It gives the buyer something that they can deduct immediately if they so choose post-purchase, and it caps the seller's exposure to amounts being treated as ordinary income rather than capital gain.
Mm-hmm. And how can the wrong structure make a good deal less attractive after closing?
If you don't go through that type of diligence process of looking at ways of focusing on the purchase price, a seller can have far more in the area of ordinary income than they'd otherwise desire. This example I just gave, by the way, doesn't necessarily apply when the seller is a C corporation, because C corporations have a single flat tax rate, irrespective of whether a transaction is treated as ordinary or capital.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of, okay, buyer, what would you like to see? It doesn't affect us. Let's get to a win-win.
Mm-hmm. And tax planning does not stop after closing either.
No. For the buy side, you want to implement everything that you agree to in the agreement. On the seller side, it's a matter of getting the tax reporting together and comparing that reporting and the results to the projections you had done beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
Where we say, okay, this is what we anticipate the tax result being. We want to make sure that there are other circumstances or other issues that crept up after the close that don't change those results significantly.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
And what some of the post-merger integration issues are most important from finance and tax perspective?
From the buyer side, it's just they're really looking at financial integration. The tax questions and issues presumably have been resolved prior to the deal being signed and closed. They really want to get other areas of integration together. Do both buyer and the newly acquired company, are they on the same accounting system? So they want to make sure that the two systems are talking to one another so they can measure the results. What type of other cleanup or integration does the buyer need to do to bring the newly acquired company in line with their financial reporting, their human resource reporting, their employee benefits, getting everybody under the same umbrella, so to speak? So for a buyer, the bigger challenges aren't necessarily tax-related after close, but it's just integration in other areas. There's an HR perspective as well, meaning that at the executive level, the sellers are very much in line with the transaction, as is the deal team. What about the rest of the executives? What about the rank-and-file employees who may or may not have been clued into this process while the deal was being negotiated? How do you integrate them? Again, this isn't a tax question per se, but it's something that's essential and integral in order for a deal to be successful post-close.
Mm-hmm. And can you give me an example of one tax planning issue that looks small at first but can change the deal outcome?
I'll go back to my earlier discussion about whether or not somebody should move prior to close. If changing domicile from a high-tax to a low-tax state is doable based upon lifestyle considerations, it needs to be done sooner rather than later. I mentioned earlier how aggressive revenue departments are. The one thing that's obvious low-hanging fruit for them is somebody that moves from New York to Florida in March and sells the company 3 weeks later in April. A change in domicile really requires years of planning, ideally at least 3 years, possibly more, because changing domicile really means the basics: changing your voter registration, changing your doctors, changing your driver's license. So there's the paperwork aspect. There's also the question of, are you really living your life as a resident of that new state?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of moving 3 or 4 years before a move, if you model this out, for a company that's looking to sell in 2029, if the person decides that a change of domicile makes sense, both lifestyle-wise and tax-wise, make the move in 2026, declare the residency in the other state, live your life as a resident of that state, the company gets sold in 2029, the tax return gets filed in 2030, by the time a revenue department or an agent decides whether or not they want to start asking questions, is now 2031, by which point you as the seller have built up a 5-year track record of really showing that you changed your domicile to that other state.
Wow. I knew that moving is horrible to begin with, but being a business owner and move is a whole other level.
Moving for tax reasons, it's not for the squeamish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds like it. And without naming any names, can you share an example of a transaction where early planning made a major difference?
The example that I just gave is something that I'm in the middle of now in terms of the reporting.
Okay.
So it was strategized well out in advance, and it's just a matter of, should questions arise later on, did the seller do everything at the personal level to make the planning hold up?
Yeah.
Another area where I mentioned planning had to do with, on the asset allocation, going through the due diligence of getting an appraisal for equipment or looking at a Kelley Blue Book of vehicles are involved in order to ascertain what a true value is. in order to maximize the tax efficiency of a deal.
Mm-hmm. And what is one question, or I guess multiple, if you'd like, a business owner should ask their advisor before going to market?
I would come back to them and say, what have you learned thus far, and what's most important to you? In terms of what they ask the advisor itself is, you know, usually it involves background. How many transactions have you been involved with? What types of issues have you seen? But the truth of the matter is that there's no deal is cookie cutter. What I work, you know, some of the strategies implemented for the first transaction may not apply in the second transaction, even if the industries are similar and the owner profiles are similar. Something different is going to be important to each respective owner. So the owner will ask their questions about what our backgrounds are, and most importantly, can you explain this to us in English rather than tax language? And then as opposed to giving them our background and then finding out what's important to them.
Mm-hmm. What's the longest deal you've ever worked with?
It's interesting. Most of the deals will close within 6 to 9 months. But as you go further up in value and you're working with somebody who's looking to sell, there have been some deals that have fallen apart just for other reasons. Either the seller didn't quite get an offer at the level desired. Maybe something changes with the buyer circumstances, which we've seen happen at the 11th hour. So, but once a deal really gets going, on a large deal, it can take 6 to 9 months, especially as the deal goes up in value. A lot depends on who the buyer is. A private equity firm might have one methodology and timeline for starting a deal. A family office or an independent sponsor might have a shorter timeline. If the buyer is a public company, it will traditionally have a longer timeline, because when you're working with a public company as a buyer, the deal structure is less important than it is to identify and mitigate every risk as best possible. So an area where I might see a public company buyer find importance has to do with payroll reporting. Are there any individuals who were treated as contractors that should have been treated as employees? We've seen situations where the buyer, in that scenario, has required the seller to restate the independent contractor and W-2 payroll reporting. So there's a lot of it depends in the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. But usually you said 6 to 9 months.
6 to 9 months.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what do you think deal teams need to do better when it comes to tax planning and structure?
Constant communication. That's where it all begins. Because if one of the groups is operating in a silo and gets brought in for a question here and there, we get the feeling as well, we can give you a technically correct we can give you a technically correct answer, but is it the one that best fits the client in the overall situation in terms of helping to get a deal over the finish line?
Mm-hmm. And what does a smart tax planning ultimately do for a transaction?
It provides the client with the best after-tax financial result, given the parameters and limitations of how they've operated, what the buyer wants, mm-hmm. etc. I mean, one of the things that it's important to recognize, and I'll go back to the discussion of whether or not becoming a C corporation for qualified small business stock, it's certainly a great cash result. But if the company has operated as an S corporation over the years and the company generates an impressive cash flow as an S corporation, it is less tax expensive from a tax standpoint as you go in order to remain an S corporation. Does that benefit take precedence over the benefits of converting to a C corporation and taking advantage of the qualified small business stock rules later on? The thing that we always have to remember is that a seller has three assets: their home, which they think nothing of taking care of in order to preserve its value, their retirement account, they'll always meet with their financial advisor, in their business. The challenge with applying a grow the asset mindset to the business is that in addition to it being an asset, it's also a source of family income. And sometimes those two goals are sometimes in conflict. So as advisors, it's incumbent upon us to bear that in mind and understand that the best possible thing to do in terms of growing the value of your business and thinking of it as an asset isn't always going to coincide with whatever your family's financial needs are at a given point in time. If you're trying to sell a company while putting two children through school, the cash flow needs may take precedence over the need of what you need to do to increase the business's value.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that as advisors we always need to be cognizant of.
Well, Rich, this has been very educational. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining me today. How can people get in touch with you and learn more about the company you work for?
Our firm's website address is www.aafcpa.com. And my email address at that domain is rweiner, R-W-E-I-N-E-R.
Perfect. Well, if you need any tax planning help, Rich is your guy.
Yep. Thank you for that. And
thank you for visiting me.
Thank you for having me.
Enjoy the summer conference.
Thank you.
These kinds of conversations are happening all the time. We'd love for you to join in, whether it's through our monthly webinars, our biannual conferences, or our CIMA certification, and then we have our chapter events across the nation all year round. You can find out more at amaaonline.com. Until then, see you next time. Thank you.